Chapter 8. Forward to the Past. Well, the wizards have made a good start. And with the might of Hex behind them, the wizards can travel at will along the round world timeline. We're happy for them to do that in a fictional context, but could we do the same thing in a factual one? To answer that, we must decide what a time machine looks like within the framework of general relativity. Then we can talk about building one. Traveling to the future is easy. Wait. It's getting back that's hard. A time machine lets a particle or object return to its own past, so its world line, a time-like curve, must close into a loop. So a time machine is just a closed time-like curve, abbreviated to CTC. Instead of asking, is time travel possible, we ask, can CTCs exist? In flat Minkowski spacetime, they can't. Forward and backward light cones, the future and past of an event, never intersect, except at the point itself, which we discount. If you head off across a flat plane, never deviating more than 45 degrees from due north, you can never sneak up on yourself from the south. But forward and backward light cones can intersect in other types of space-time. The first person to notice this was Kurt Gödel, better known for his fundamental work in mathematical logic. In 1949, he worked out the relativistic mathematics of a rotating universe and discovered that the past and future of every point intersect. Start wherever and whenever you like, travel into your future, and you'll end up in your own past. However, observations indicate that the universe is not rotating, and spinning up a stationary universe, especially from inside, doesn't look like a plausible way to make a time machine. Though if the wizards were to give Round World a twirl... The simplest example of future meeting past arises if you take Minkowski space-time and roll it up along the vertical time direction to form a cylinder. Then the time coordinate becomes cyclic, as in Hindu mythology, where Brahma recreates the universe every kalpa, a period of 4.32 billion years. Although a cylinder looks curved, the corresponding space-time is not actually curved, not in the gravitational sense. When you roll up a sheet of paper into a cylinder, it doesn't distort. You can flatten it out again, and the paper is not folded or wrinkled. An ant that is confined purely to the surface won't notice that space-time has been bent, because distances on the surface haven't changed. In short, the local metric doesn't change. What changes is the global geometry of space-time, its overall topology. Rolling up Minkowski space-time is an example of a powerful mathematical trick for building new space-times out of old ones, cut and paste. If you can cut pieces out of known space-times and glue them together without distorting their metrics, then the result is also a possible space-time. We say distorting the metric rather than bending for exactly the reason that we say that rolled up Minkowski space-time is not curved. We're talking about intrinsic curvature, as experienced by a creature that lives in the space-time, not about apparent curvature, as seen by some external viewer. The rolled-up version of Minkowski space-time is a very simple way to prove that space-times that obey the Einstein equations can possess CTCs, and thus that time travel is not inconsistent with currently known physics. But that doesn't imply that time travel is possible. There is a very important distinction between what is mathematically possible and what is physically feasible. A space-time is mathematically possible if it obeys the Einstein equations. It is physically feasible if it can exist or could be created as part of our own universe or an add-on. There's no very good reason to suppose that rolled-up Minkowski space-time is physically feasible. Certainly, it would be hard to refashion the universe in that form if it wasn't already endowed with cyclic time. And right now, very few people, other than Hindus, think that it is. The search for space-times that possess CTCs and have plausible physics is a search for more plausible topologies. There are many mathematically possible topologies, but as with the Irishman giving directions, you can't get to all of them from here. However, you can get to some remarkably interesting ones. All you need is black hole engineering. Oh, and white holes too. And negative energy. And one step at a time. Black holes first. They were first predicted in classical Newtonian mechanics, where there is no limit to the speed of a moving object. Particles can escape from an attracting mass, however strong its gravitational field, by moving faster than the appropriate escape velocity. For the Earth, this is 7 miles per second, 11 kilometers per second. And for the Sun, it is 26 miles per second, 41 kilometers per second. In an article presented to the Royal Society in 1783, John Michell observed that the concept of escape velocity, combined with a finite speed of light, implies that sufficiently massive objects cannot emit light at all, because the speed of light will be lower than the escape velocity. In 1796, Pierre Simon de Laplace repeated these observations in his Exposition of the System of the World. Both of them imagined that the universe might be littered with huge bodies, bigger than stars, but totally dark. They were a century ahead of their time. In 1915, Karl Schwarzschild took the first step towards answering the relativistic version of the same question, when he solved the Einstein equations for the gravitational field around a massive sphere in a vacuum. His solution behaved very strangely at a critical distance from the center of the sphere, now called the Schwarzschild radius. It is equal to the mass of the star multiplied by the square of the speed of light multiplied by twice the gravitational constant, if you must know. The Schwarzschild radius for the Sun is 1.2 miles, 2 kilometers, and for the Earth, 0.4 inches, 1 centimeter. Both buried inaccessibly deep, where they can't cause trouble. So it wasn't entirely clear how significant the strange mathematical behavior was, or even what it meant. What would happen to a star that is so dense that it lies inside its own Schwarzschild radius? In 1939, Robert Oppenheimer and Hartland Snyder showed that it would collapse under its own gravitational attraction. Indeed, a whole portion of space-time would collapse to form a region from which no matter, not even light, could escape. This was the birth of an exciting new physical concept. In 1967, John Archibald Wheeler coined the term black hole, and the new concept was christened. How does a black hole develop as time passes? An initial clump of matter shrinks to the Schwarzschild radius, and then continues to shrink until, after a finite time, all the mass has collapsed to a single point called a singularity. From outside, though, we can't observe the singularity. It lies beyond the event horizon at the Schwarzschild radius, which separates the observable region from which light can escape and the unobservable region, where the light is trapped. If you were to watch a black hole collapse from outside, you would see the star shrinking towards the Schwarzschild radius, but you'd never see it get there. As it shrinks, its speed of collapse, as seen from outside, approaches that of light, and relativistic time dilation implies that the entire collapse takes infinitely long when seen by an outside observer. The light from the star would shift deeper and deeper into the red end of the spectrum. The name should be red hole. Black holes are ideal for space-time engineering. You can cut and paste a black hole into any universe that has asymptotically flat regions, such as our own. This is a mathematician's way of saying that you can put a black hole anywhere you want, or, like a gorilla in a mini, it can go anywhere it wants. This makes black hole topology physically plausible in our universe. Indeed, the scenario of gravitational collapse makes it even more plausible. You just have to start with a big enough concentration of matter, such as a neutron star or the center of a galaxy. A technologically advanced society could build black holes. A black hole doesn't possess CTCs, though, so we haven't achieved time travel. Yet. However, we're getting close. The next step uses the time reversibility of Einstein's equations. To every solution, there corresponds another that is just the same, except the time runs backwards. The time reversal of a black hole is called a white hole. A black hole's event horizon is a barrier from which no particle can escape. A white hole's event horizon is one into which no particle can fall, but from which particles may emerge at any moment. So, seen from the outside, a white hole would appear as the sudden explosion of a star's worth of matter, coming from a time-reversed event horizon. White holes may seem rather strange. It makes sense for an initial concentration of matter to collapse if it is dense enough and thus to form a black hole. But why should the singularity inside a white hole suddenly decide to spew forth a star, having remained unchanged since the dawn of time? Perhaps because time runs backwards inside a white hole, so causality runs from future to past. Let's just agree that white holes are a mathematical possibility, and notice that they too are asymptotically flat. So if you knew how to make one, you could glue it neatly into your own universe too. Not only that, you can glue a black hole and a white hole together. Cut them along their event horizons and paste along these two horizons. The result is a sort of tube. Matter can pass through the tube in one direction only, into the black hole and out of the white. It's a kind of matter valve. The passage through the valve follows a time-like curve because material particles can indeed traverse it. Both ends of the tube can be glued into any asymptotically flat region of any space-time. You could glue one end into our universe and the other end into somebody else's. Or you could glue both ends into ours, anywhere you like except near a concentration of matter. Now, you've got a wormhole. The distance through the wormhole is very short, whereas that between the two openings, across normal space-time, can be as big as you like. A wormhole is a shortcut through the universe. But that's matter transmission, not time travel. Never mind, we're nearly there. The key to wormhole time travel is the notorious twin paradox, pointed out by the physicist Paul Langevin in 1911. Recall that, in relativity, time passes more slowly the faster you go, and stops altogether at the speed of light. This effect is known as time dilation. We quote from The Science of Discworld. Suppose that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are born on Earth on the same day. Rosencrantz stays there all his life, while Guildenstern travels away at nearly light speed, and then turns round and comes home again. Because of time dilation, only 1 year, say, has passed for Guildenstern, whereas 40 years have gone by for Rosencrantz. So Guildenstern is now 39 years younger than his twin brother. It's called a paradox because there seems to be a puzzle. From Guildenstern's frame of reference, it is Rosencrantz who has whizzed off at near light speed. Surely by the same token, Rosencrantz should be 39 years younger, not Guildenstern. But the apparent symmetry is fallacious. Guildenstern's frame of reference is subject to acceleration and deceleration, especially when he turns round to head for home. Rosencrantz isn't. In relativity, accelerations make a big difference. In 1988, Michael Morris, Kip Thorne and Ulvi Yurtsever realized that combining a wormhole with the twin paradox yields a CTC. The idea is to leave the white end of the wormhole fixed and to zigzag the black one back and forth at just below the speed of light. As the black end zigzags, time dilation comes into play, and time passes more slowly for an observer moving with that end. Think about world lines that join the two wormholes through normal space, so that the time experienced by observers at each end are the same. At first, those lines are almost horizontal, so they are not time-like, and it is not possible for material particles to proceed along them. But as time passes, the line gets closer to the vertical, and eventually it becomes time-like. Once this time barrier is crossed, you can travel from the white end of the wormhole to the black through normal space, following a time-like curve. Because the wormhole is a shortcut, you can do so in a very short period of time, effectively travelling instantly from the black end to the corresponding white one. This is the same place as your starting point, but in the past. You've travelled in time. By waiting, you can close the path into a CTC and end up at the same place and time that you started from, not back to the future, but forward to the past. The further into the future your starting point is, the further back in time you can travel from that point. But there's one disadvantage of this method. You can never travel back past the time barrier, and that occurs sometime after you build the wormholes. No hope of going back to hunt dinosaurs or to tread on Cretaceous butterflies. Could we really make one of these devices? Could we really get through the wormhole? In 1966, Robert Geroce discovered a theoretical way to warp space-time smoothly without tearing it to create a wormhole. There's a snag, though. At one point in the construction, time becomes so twisted that the wormhole turns into a temporary time machine, and equipment from late in the construction gets carried back to the beginning. The builder's tools might vanish into the past, just as they thought they had finished. Still, with the right work schedule, that might not matter. Perhaps a technologically advanced civilization could build black and white holes and move them around by creating intense gravitational fields. But building a wormhole is not the only obstacle. Keeping it open is another. The main trouble is the cat flap effect. When you move a mass through a wormhole, the hole tends to shut on your tail. It turns out that in order to get through without getting your tail trapped, you have to travel faster than light, so that's no good. Any time-like path that starts at the wormhole entrance must run into the future singularity. There's no way to get across to the exit without exceeding the speed of light. The traditional way around this difficulty is to thread the wormhole with exotic matter, which exerts enormous negative pressure like a stretched spring. It is a form of negative energy and is thus different from antimatter, which has positive energy. In quantum mechanics, a vacuum is not empty. It is a turbulent sea of particles coming into being and disappearing again. Zero energy includes all these fluctuations, so you can get negative energy if you can calm the waves. One way to do this is the Casimir effect, discovered in 1948. If two metal plates are held very close together, then in between you find a negative energy state. This effect has been observed in experiments, but it's very weak. To get enough negative energy, you need galaxy-sized plates, rigid ones, to maintain the gap. Another possibility is a magnetic wormhole. In 1907, the geometer Tullio Levi-Civita prove that in general relativity, a magnetic field can warp space. Magnetism has energy. Energy is equivalent to mass, and mass is spatial curvature. Moreover, he found an exact mathematical solution to Einstein's field equations, which he called magnetic gravity. The trouble was, this effect could only be observed using a magnetic field 1 quintillion times as large as anything that could be obtained in a laboratory. The idea languished until 1995, when Claudio Marconi realized that Levi-Civita had actually come up with a magnetic wormhole. The stronger the magnetic field, the more tightly curved the wormhole mouth is. A wormhole whose magnetic field was the strength you can get in a laboratory would be enormous, about 150 light years across, and you'd need laboratories everywhere along it. It's making a small wormhole that needs a gigantic magnetic field. Marconi suggested that the surface of a neutron star, where very strong magnetic fields can occur, might be a good place to look for magnetic wormholes. Why bother? Because a magnetic wormhole can stay open, without any need for exotic matter. A better solution, though, might be to employ a rotating black hole, which has a ring singularity, not a point one. Passers-by can go through the ring and miss the singularity. The mathematics of Einstein's equations tells us that a rotating black hole connects to infinitely many different regions of space-time. One must be in our universe, assuming that we built the rotating black hole in our universe, but the others need not be. Beyond the ring singularity lie anti-gravity universes, in which distances are negative and matter repels other matter. There are legal, slower-than-light, paths through the wormhole to any of its alternative exits. So, if we use a rotating black hole instead of a wormhole, and if we can find a way to tow its entrances and exits around at nearly light speed, we'll get a much more practical time machine. One that we can get through without running into the singularity. There are other time machines based on the twin paradox, but all of them are limited by the speed of light. They would work better and perhaps be easier to build and operate if you could follow Star Trek and engage your warp drive, travelling faster than light. But relativity forbids that, right? Wrong. Special relativity forbids that. General relativity, it turns out, permits it. The amazing thing is that the way it permits it turns out to be standard science fiction gobbledygook, invoked by innumerable writers who knew about relativistic limitations but still wanted their starships to travel faster than light. Relativity forbids matter travelling faster than light, they would incant. But it doesn't forbid space travelling faster than light. Put your starship in a region of space and leave it stationary relative to that region. No violation of Einstein there. Now, move the entire region of space, starship inside, with superluminal faster-than-light speed. Bingo! Haha, most amusing. Except, in the context of general relativity, that's exactly what Miguel Alcubierre Moya came up with in 1994. He proved that there exist solutions of Einstein's field equations involving a local warping of space-time to form a mobile bubble. Space contracts ahead of the bubble and expands behind it. Put a starship inside the bubble and it can surf a gravitational wave cocooned inside a static shell of local space-time. The speed of the starship relative to the bubble is zero. Only the bubble's boundary moves. And that's just empty space. The SF writers were right. There is no relativistic limit to the speed with which space can move. Warp drives have the same drawback as wormholes. You need exotic matter to create the gravitational repulsion needed to distort space-time in this unusual way. Other schemes for warp drives have been proposed, which allegedly overcome this obstacle, but they have their own drawbacks. Sergei Krasnikov noticed one awkward feature of Alcubierre's warp drive. The inside of the bubble becomes causally disconnected from the front edge. The starship's captain inside the bubble can't steer it, and she can't even turn it on or off. He proposed a different method, a superluminal highway. On the outward trip, the starship travels below light speed and leaves a tube of distorted space-time behind it. On the way back, it travels faster than light along the tube. The superluminal highway also needs negative energy. In fact, Ken Ollam and others have proved that any type of warp drive does. There are limits to the lifetime of any given amount of negative energy. For wormholes and warp drives, these limits imply that such structures must either be very small or else the region of negative energy must be extremely thin. For example, a wormhole whose mouth is 3 feet, 1 meter, across must confine its negative energy to a band whose thickness is 1/1,000,000th of a diameter of a proton. The total negative energy required would be equivalent to the total output in positive energy of 10 billion stars for 1 year. If the mouth were 1 light-year across, then the thickness of the negative energy band would still be smaller than a proton, and now the negative energy requirement would be that of 10 quadrillion stars. Warp drives, if anything, are worse. To travel at 10 times light speed, a mere Star Trek warp factor 2, the thickness of the bubble's wall must be 10 to the power minus 32 meters. If the starship is 200 yards, 200 meters long, the energy required to make the bubble has to be 10 billion times the mass of the known universe. Engage. Round world narrativium can sometimes be documented. When Ronald Mallett was 10 years old, his 33-year-old father died of heart failure, brought on by drinking and smoking. "It completely devastated me," he is reported to have said. Michael Brooks, Time Twister, New Scientist, the 19th of May 2001, pages 27 to 29. Soon after, he read Wells's The Time Machine, and he reasoned that if I could build a time machine, I might be able to warn him about what was going to happen. The childish idea faded, but the interest in time travel did not. As an adult, Mallett invented an entirely new type of time machine, one that uses bent light. Morris and Thorne bent space to make a wormhole using matter. Mass is curved space. Levi-Civita bent space using magnetism. Magnetism has energy. Energy is, so Einstein tells us, mass. Mallett prefers to bend space using light. Light too has energy, so it can act like mass. In 2000, he published a paper on the deformation of space by a circular beam of light. Then it hit him. If you can deform space, you ought to be able to deform time too. And his calculations showed that a ring of light could create a ring of time, a CTC. With a Mallett bent light time machine, you can walk into your past. A time traveller makes his or her way into the closed loop of light, space and time. Walking round the loop has the same effect as moving backwards in time. The more times he walks round the loop, the further back he goes, tracing out a helical world line. When he has gone sufficiently far into his past, he exits the loop. Easy. Yes, but we've been here before. It takes huge amounts of energy to make a circular beam of light. That's true, unless you can slow the light down. A ring of really slow light, Discworld speed, like that of sound on Roundworld, is much easier to make. The reason is that as light slows down, it gains inertia. This gives it more energy, and the warping effect is far greater for less effort on the part of the builder. Relativity tells us that the speed of light is constant, in a vacuum. In other media, light slows down. This is why glass refracts light, for example. In the right medium, light can be slowed to walking pace, or even stopped altogether. Experiments by Lenny Howe demonstrated this effect in 2001, using a medium known as Bose-Einstein condensate. This is a curious degenerate form of matter occurring at temperatures near absolute zero. It consists of lots of atoms in exactly the same quantum state, forming a superfluid with zero viscosity. So maybe Wells' time traveller could have included some refrigeration equipment and a laser in his machine. But a Mallett bent light time machine suffers from the same limitation as a wormhole one. You can't travel back to any time before the machine was constructed. Wells was probably right to eliminate that encounter with a giant hippopotamus. These are purely relativistic time machines, but the universe has quantum features too, and these should be taken into account. The search for a unification of relativity and quantum theory, respectably known as quantum gravity and often derided as a theory of everything, has turned up a beautiful mathematical proposal, string theory. In this theory, instead of fundamental particles being points, they are vibrating multidimensional loops. The best-known version uses six-dimensional loops, so its model of space-time is really 10-dimensional. Why has no one noticed? Perhaps because the extra six dimensions are curled up so tightly that no one has observed them. Very possibly, can observe them. Or perhaps, the Irishman again, we can't go that way from here. Many physicists hope that string theory, as well as unifying relativity and quantum mechanics, will also supply a proof of Hawking's chronology protection conjecture, that the universe conspires to keep events happening in the same temporal order. In this connection, there is a five-dimensional string theoretic rotating black hole called a BMPV. Jason Breckenridge, Rob Myers, Amanda Peet and Kumram Vafa. If this rotates fast enough, it has CTCs outside the black hole region. Theoretically, you can build one from gravitational waves and esoteric string theoretic gadgets called D-brains. And here we see a hint of Hawking's cosmological time cops. Lisa Dyson took a careful look at just what happens when you put the gravitational waves and D-brains together. Just as the black hole is within a gnat's whisker of turning into a time machine, the components stop collecting together in the same place. Instead, they form a shell of gravitons, hypothetical particles of gravity analogous to photons for light. The D-brains are trapped inside the shell. The gravitons can't be persuaded to come any closer, and the BMPV can't be made to spin rapidly enough to create an accessible CTC. The laws of physics won't let you put this kind of time machine together unless some clever kind of scaffolding can be invented. Quantum mechanics adds a new spin to the whole time travel game. For a start, it may open up a way to create a wormhole. On the very tiny length scale of the quantum world, known as the Planck length, around 10 to the minus 35 meters, space-time is thought to be a quantum foam, a perpetually changing mass of tiny wormholes. Quantum foam is a kind of time machine. Time is slopping around inside the foam like spindrift bobbing on the ocean waves. You just have to harness it. An advanced civilization might be able to use gravitational manipulators to grab a quantum wormhole and enlarge it to macroscopic size. Quantum mechanics also sheds light, or possibly dark, on the paradoxes of time travel. Quantum mechanics is indeterminate. Many events, such as the decay of a radioactive atom, are random. One way to make this indeterminacy mathematically respectable is the many-worlds interpretation of Hugh Everett III. This view of the universe is very familiar to readers of science fiction. Our world is just one of an infinite family of parallel worlds in which every combination of possibilities occurs. This is a dramatic way to describe quantum superposition of states, in which an electron spin can be both up and down at the same time, and, allegedly, a cat can be both alive and dead. It's okay for electrons, and probably nonsense for cats. See Grebo's cameo appearance in The Science of Discworld. In 1991, David Deutsch argued that, thanks to the many worlds interpretation, quantum mechanical time travel poses no obstacles to free will. The grandfather paradox ceases to be paradoxical because granddad will be, or will have been, killed in a parallel world, not in the original one. We find this a bit of a cheat. Yes, it resolves the paradox, but only by showing that it wasn't really time travel at all. It was travel to a parallel world. Fun, but not the same. We also agree with a number of physicists, among them Roger Penrose, who accept that the many worlds interpretation of quantum theory is an effective mathematical description, but deny that the parallel worlds involved are in any sense real. Here's an analogy. Using a mathematical technique called Fourier analysis, you can resolve any periodic sound, such as the note played by a clarinet, into a superposition of pure sounds that involve only one vibrational frequency. In a sense, the pure sounds form a series of parallel notes, which together create the real note. But you don't find anyone asserting that there must therefore exist a corresponding set of parallel clarinets, each producing one of the pure notes. The mathematical decomposition need not have a literal physical analogue. What about paradoxes of genuine time travel? No faffing about with parallel worlds. In the relativistic setting, which is where such questions most naturally arise, there is an interesting resolution. If you set up a situation with paradoxical possibilities, it automatically leads to consistent behavior. A typical thought experiment here is to send a billiard ball through a wormhole so that it emerges in its own past. With care, you can send it in so that when it came out, it bashes into its earlier incarnation, deflecting it, so that it never enters the wormhole in the first place. This is the grandfather paradox in less violent form. The question for a physicist is, can you actually set such paradoxical states up? You have to do so before the time machine is built, then build it and see what physical behavior actually occurs. It turns out that, at least in the simplest mathematical formulation of this question, the usual physical laws select a unique, logically consistent behavior. You can't suddenly plonk a billiard ball down inside a pre-existing system. That act involves human intervention, free will, and its relation to the laws of physics is moot. If you leave it up to the billiard ball, it follows a path that does not introduce logical inconsistencies. It is not yet known whether similar results hold in more general circumstances, but they may well do. This is all very well, but it does beg the free will question. It's a deterministic explanation, valid for idealized physical systems like billiard balls. Now, is it possible that the human mind is actually a deterministic system, ignoring quantum effects to keep the discussion within bounds? What we like to think of as making a free choice may actually be what it feels like when a deterministic brain works its way towards the only decision that it can actually reach. Free will may be the quale of decision-making, the vivid feeling we get, like the vivid sense of colour we get when we look at a red flower. See Ian Stewart, Jack Cohen, Figments of Reality, The Origins of the Curious Mind. Cambridge University Press, 1997. Physics does not yet explain how these feelings arise, so it is usual to dismiss effects of free will when discussing possible temporal paradoxes. This sounds reasonable, but there's a catch. The whole discussion of time machines, in physics terms, is about the possibility of people constructing the various warped space-times that are involved. Get a black hole, join it to a white one. Specifically, it is about people choosing or deciding to construct such a device. In a deterministic world, either they are bound to construct it from the beginning, in which case construct isn't a very appropriate word, or the thing just puts itself together and you find out what sort of universe you are in. It's just like Gödel's rotating universe. Either you're in it or you're not, and you don't get to change anything. You can't bring a time machine into being unless it was already implicit in the unfolding of that universe anyway. The standard physics viewpoint really only makes sense in a world where people have free will and can choose to build or not to build as they see fit. So physics, not for the first time, has adopted inconsistent viewpoints for different aspects of the same question, and has got its philosophical knickers in a twist as a result. For all the clever theorizing, the dreadful truth is that we do not yet have the foggiest idea how to make a practical time machine. The clumsy and energy-wasteful devices of real physics are a pale shadow of the elegant machine of Wells's Time Traveller, whose prototype was described as a glittering metallic framework, scarcely larger than a small clock. Very delicately made, there was ivory in it, and some transparent crystalline substance. There's still some R&D needed. Probably, this is a good thing.